The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Hello, Zero Books readers. It's me again, Douglas Lane, and this episode of the Zero Books podcast features Ralph Leonard, a British-Nigerian who writes on international politics, religion, culture, and humanism. It's Wednesday, June 17th, 2020, and if you enjoy Zero Books, support us on Patreon, where you'll get access to every episode of Pop the Left and Zero Squared. Right now, you're listening to the YouTuber Isto play Harold Arlen's It's Only a Paper Moon. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ralph, Leonard, and I discuss the revolutionary subject.
Say it's only a paper moon hanging over a cardboard sea.
So, Ralph, thanks for coming on to the live stream. I wanted to talk to you about CLR. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about CLR James. Because he's kind of an important figure for me in the background. I went through a period of being involved with Marxist humanism, and by extension through that with the works of Raya Donskaya. Although I'm no expert in her work, I've read a bit of her, and I'm very interested right now in the debates around or the question of voluntarism and determinism. Because I feel like figuring that out right now will be really useful. we're in a real crisis, and this is a living issue. So I wanted to get you on the live stream because you are such a fan of CLR James. Your profile picture at Medium and on Twitter are both photographs not of yourself but of CLR James. So I guess I should start by asking you, how deep of an identification do you have with the CLR James?
I wouldn't recommend having heroes as such, but if I were to have one, he would be one of them. It's weird because when I first read CLR James, it was his book, his magnum corpus, Black Jacobins, and I wasn't a Marxist or the sort. I wasn't a Marxist really then. I was more of a black radical, and it was actually through CLR that I came to Marxism by the back door, because he represented a sort of a tradition within the Marxist tradition itself that rejected the authoritarianism of Stalinism. I think Christopher Hitchens once said of George Orwell that he was on the right side of the three great questions of the 20th century, fascism, Stalinism, and imperialism. And the same thing can be said of CLR James. That's really what, makes me admire him so much. And also that he also expressed a very firmly universalist and humanist point of view in terms of he believed in sort of the power of human beings to change their world, that he believed human beings to be the subjects of history and the makers of history, not its objects.
Well, my aim today, and with your help, is to be as critical of CLR James as I can be while holding on to the same priorities and values that he held onto. When CLR James, because what we're going to be talking about is this essay, or actually, I guess, his speech from 1948, which I think lays out an argument pretty persuasively, especially probably in that moment, for the black worker in America to be considered as the new vanguard, the group that should be looked to lead the struggle for a revolutionary transformation, and also that there that would mean that the communists in the United States or and around the world should focus their support on civil rights questions for black people in America at that time as well. And, you know, obviously, in retrospect, there's no question that it was important to support the civil rights struggles that were coming up around that time. That can't really be questioned. The question of whether or not the black workers in America represented a new revolutionary vanguard or the revolutionary vanguard is maybe a little bit more tricky.
I think the argument in his sort of rather long speech is basically that sort of black people in America, because of their very specific social position in America, are placed in such a way that if they mobilize en masse in a big way, that they can sort of really shake at the roots of American capitalism and oppression, because obviously back then you had Jim Crow, where basically an entire class of people did not have citizenship, and black people in the South basically lived under semi-totalitarian sort of racist dictatorship of a sort. And in that speech, he sort of talks about how the independent Negro struggle has, you know, a vitality and validity of its own. So he puts it outside of sort of class solidarity. But this is the bit where C.L.R. James is more nuanced, because he doesn't talk about black people as like a separate nation. So he doesn't buy into the, you know, the black nation thesis of that was sort of on vogue in the 1930s. He was basically saying that, and he also even conceded that black people and white Americans in so many ways share the same characteristics, share the same religion, speak the same language, and broadly speaking, share the same culture. I think, again, broadly speaking. So they're not, it's not as if you're dealing with a distinct hermetically sealed nationality within US borders. But he said that, you know, by their agitation and resistance, they can initiate a set of events where the proletariat, the socialist proletariat, that can be the real power against imperialism and capitalism, can come onto the scene. So it's not that black people as such in and of themselves are the new revolutionary vanguard, but they can, I think he puts it that they are, the struggle is the bacalli, that's the word he used, for the socialist proletariat, black and white, to unite. But also, this is the other nuanced point, that he also said that this doesn't always have to be the case, and it doesn't have to happen every time. It's not the sole means, it's just one of the means by which you can sort of ignite a revolution in America.
Right. He was definitely speaking to his particular historical moment, although I think he would stick with this idea well past the 40s. I mean, I think he continued to believe in the black worker as a vanguard of the proletariat until his death. Do you think that when he talked about the black vanguard, that he was saying something a little bit different than what Marx wrote when he said that labor in the white skin cannot emancipate itself where the black skin is branded. That is, did James think that the oppression of the black worker was a way for the capitalist class to undermine the political power of the white majority of workers with a reserve of cheaper labor power? And that might be like one of the first reasons to support the struggle for democratic rights for black workers, is because that was necessary to overcome the basically it was necessary to get bourgeois rights for all workers in the United States so that the working class could organize politically in their own interest. Do you think that's what he was arguing, or is it a little different than that?
Basically, yes. Because he only gives this sort of argument for the United States and South Africa, which is where the other apartheid state. He doesn't give this sort of argument for anywhere else. I would say that, especially because I have to mention the historical context, because this was 1940s America with Jim Crow, where you have an entire class of people without citizenship of any sort. And I think then it was important for black people to get their democratic rights. I mean, remember, this was the time of the 1941 March on Washington, the original March on Washington with A. Philip Randolph and various black trade union leaders, when they sort of protested against the Roosevelt government to get their rights and as well economic justice as well.
Let's see, I've written down here that I think we should understand that James is making an argument not so much from the perspective of an imagined monolithic black politics, but from within the Marxist tradition. And I think what you've said so far would agree with that idea. But I'm also thinking of, like, if you take it out of that historical moment and kind of think of it as a continuing problem for the Marxist struggle, you can see him trying to overcome what had become a crisis in Marxism in the 19th century after the Long Depression, the failure of socialism to arise out of the economic crisis in Europe led Edward Bernstein to critique some core Marxist concepts and to try to move in a more reformist direction and to kind of reject the idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat, or to put it in terms that don't seem as inflammatory, the need for a working class control over the state as they transform the basis of production and our most fundamental social relations. Yeah, they became reformists. They argued against the need for a revolutionary struggle based on the fact that the proletariat was no longer or couldn't be seen to be kind of driven to revolution, that they had been incorporated into the bourgeois state. And this would have been – this argument for the black vanguard would have been an argument for the proletariat overall as a revolutionary force in and of itself. Maybe an argument against Lenin's assertion that, you know, the proletariat on its own will never overcome trade union consciousness. Because he's also arguing for labor throughout the same lecture. He's not just arguing for the black vanguard, but he's arguing for – the power of the labor movement overall.
He's not trying to surreptitiously sort of smuggle in black nationalism because he says pretty explicitly that we should fight against black nationalism, and we should, and part of the reason why the socialist left should support the black struggle is so that black petty bourgeois intellectuals don't monopolize, the struggle for black proletariat for democratic rights.
But nonetheless, the problem of this crisis in Marxism that came up in the 19th century hasn't really quite been resolved. I mean, it's actually in that moment popping up again after the Great Depression. I mean, if you look to like the Frankfurt School Marxist as an example, or even I think Cornelius Castoriadis and C.L.R. James a little bit later on, there was a sense that you can no longer rely on class struggle as the engine for revolutionary change. You can no longer rely on the proletariat as a revolutionary force. And that was coming. And they weren't trying to become they did not move in a reformist direction. Nonetheless, they were trying to address the problem. And C.L.R. James particularly was trying to address this problem, saying, look, the place to look for the new vanguard, the place to look for the revolution is in the Black American worker. And we can't be discouraged after World War II. We can't be so discouraged after the failure of socialism to arise out of the Depression, because we're ignoring this whole sector of the working class, which really does have radical ambitions.
Especially because Black Americans, pretty much for their whole history, have been in an antagonistic relationship with the American state. So you could easily sort of draw upon that to ignite revolutionary ferment. But to get to your point about the crisis within Marxism and whether the proletariat is still the revolutionary agent. The context is also that after World War II, you had, what was called, the affluent society came up, the supposed embourgeoisement of the working class, and various intellectuals sort of were despaired at this sight and felt that the working class was basically being bought off by the bourgeoisie, by the capitalist class, and that they're basically assimilated into the new modern capitalist consumerist logic or ideology.
Yeah, I mean, you've written about this recently, right? I mean, you've been critical of the critique of consumerism in a recent blog post on Medium. So you've already kind of gone on the record to be opposed to the kinds of critiques of capitalism that came out of the defeat that was World War II. I mean, I'm not saying that. Well, the reason it was a defeat for the Marxist left was because the Depression didn't produce socialism, because of the boom after World War II,
and really going back further, the failure of the Russian Revolution to spread
itself. Yeah,
especially when the German Revolution was defeated.
Right, but the critique of consumerism didn't arise until until the 40s and 50s, and.
Yeah.
So just to lay that out, I have my own critique of the critique of consumerism. But what would yours be? Why do you think it isn't the case that capitalism figured out a way to just buy off the proletariat from their socialist ambitions, to cancel those out with like a check or with some, like yo-yos and hula hoops and soda pop? a tract house in the suburbs and so on.
Well, I think it really goes back to how one views capitalism, because there is this strong strain on the left, which I think is very Rousseau. It has the echoes of Rousseau it's hostile against capitalism for the wrong reasons, that they don't like capitalism because it's producing material goods on an abundant scale on a mass scale, even to enrich people, and you know, it's almost a very Christian way of seeing it, that they fundamentally think it's buttressing alienation and, you know, evacuating people of spiritual and numinous concern, when I think that consumerism, in a sense, it can be a good thing, not always a bad thing. And the relationship between capitalism and consumerism is very complicated, because capitalism has been known to be trying to decline people's standards of living through austerity politics, and there's also this ideology within the bourgeois society, going back to Ebenezer Scrooge in Charles Dickens's novels, because the reason Scrooge hated Christmas is precisely because people were having too much. And it goes.
So okay.
Sorry, because just want to add.
Keep going.
Because there's always been this image of the capitalist as the sort of thrifty, stingy investor who defers gratification so that he can continuously, endlessly make profit after profit after profit, but he doesn't spend it. He's just keep on investing, make more money, and then keep on investing. And I think that a lot of the socialist arguments against consumerism sort of inherits this sort of anti-pleasure, anti-fun. I don't want to say Puritan, because that's probably a bit too strong, but it does veer into that direction, in my opinion.
I think that the problem with consumerism, if you want to give it like a nuanced argument for a critique of consumerism, it would be that it individuates people, and you could turn to Marx's critique of the fetish nature of the commodity and say, look, the dominance of the commodity in the market keeps people from understanding their social relationships that are actually productive. That the problem with consumerism is it reduces people's freedom to the realm of their own individual ability to operate in the market, rather than give people the option or open up the field of understanding so that they can see that it's their cooperative efforts that are truly creating wealth in the world, rather than their adventures in the market. So that would be my critique. I think a relatively legitimate critique of consumerism, if you truly think that the limits of human freedom can be found through individual purchases, then you're trapped in a consumerist nightmare.
Mm-hmm. And you could advance that into saying that consumerism taken to a high level can sort of distort political action, so that you have this idea that you can affect political change through your consumer choices, through what you buy, what you don't buy. I think Zizek gives this his classic anecdote about Starbucks, and you buy Starbucks, then you're helping children in Guatemala. When that sort of thing sort of can obfuscate, the structural problems of why people in Guatemala are poor in the first place.
Yeah, the problem is just that the rich nations haven't donated 1% of everything to them yet. Yeah. That's why they're poor,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but ultimately on the consumerism point is also that I think there is a strain on the left that is hostile to sort of an economy of abundance, which is really what consumerism in its the flowering of consumer objects and gadgets and so on and so forth is speaking to, that because there has historically been a tradition within socialism and Marxism about creating an abundance for society that would, you know, dwarf anything capitalism that has ever done. I mean, Sylvia Pankhurst has talked about it, even Trotsky, you know, Marx himself. They've all, and Engels as well, in his precursor to the Communist Manifesto, also talked about this. And it seems to me that because of what happened in the Second World War and the Great Depression, the failure of, you know, classical Marxism to actually work, that, you know, people, the left sort of did a reverse break and go into a different direction.
The Pepsi generation. Drink light, drink great, drink right.
Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
The true vision of the socialists would be, our aim should be to put Elon Musk to shame. Our car, when we throw a stone at it, will bounce off. We won't have any broken windows, you know, in our bulletproof cars in the future or whatever. I agree with you. But it does bring us back to the problem itself, right? I mean, the problem of the failure of socialist revolution in the 20th century, or you could even, you know, in the 19th century. I guess the question is, because, I mean, with consumerism, one of the things that's going on there is that the socialists are blaming the working class for their failure to be radical, right? Horkheimer and Adorno and the Frankfurt School guys are all sitting back in the university and tut-tutting at the generation of humanity into one dimension and the flattening out of the understanding of humanity, which includes the working class. And let's face it, it was primarily the working class that they were criticizing, right? The consumer class. So I can scoff at their elitism, but I can't overcome the problem of the need for a vanguard party or settle the question of whether there is a need for a vanguard party. And it seems to me like today, we're really facing that question in America. Maybe we won't be in a week's time, but right now, with the autonomous zone in Seattle and the quickly fading memory of the President of the United States hiding in a bunker from the masses at the gates, you know, we are asking ourselves, what do we need to take this to the next step? What do we need to actually make a transformation in the world? And can we rely on C.L.R. James and his vision of the Black vanguard? Do we just need to give Black people in America more attention and they already have Marx all understood? Or do we need to have some vanguard party coming from the new school in New York City to direct everything? Or what do we need? So I want to throw that to you. I know it's a very big question, but
this is why I think C.L.R. James is probably at his weakest, because in his later years, when he broke off from Trotskyism officially and became more independent, he formulated a view that seemingly sort of rejected any need for a vanguard party or any sort of organized form at all. So it's almost a sort of a form of autonomism, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I think that,
believe me, I know what you mean. It's happening in Seattle right now.
Yeah,
go on.
Yeah, well, when I disagree, because I think it is obviously I wouldn't want sort of a top down sort of dictatorial authoritarian party setting the terms of the debate. But I do think it is important that you have some kind of organized form. It could be a party or some kind of structure, just so that whatever the feelings and sentiments and action that is taking place can be coherent and can be sort of channeled in a very more productive direction, rather than flaring around all over the place, doing nothing in essence.
So you are basically yourself on the side of Lenin over CLR James, or on the side of the need for some sort of vanguard party structure in moments of crisis, at least to help give a shape to a struggle.
Yeah, more or less. But this is the one of the contradictions about CLR James, because he maintained his admiration for Lenin all throughout his life, even after he left Trotskyism and became a proto-autonomist, because he admired within Lenin his strategic and tactical nous, while still being very, very principled. And it's sort of funny, because CLR James didn't really admire Rosa Luxemburg all that much on this sort of specific point, because he found her very romantic and overly idealistic, when his politics towards the end actually was more in line with Rosa Luxemburg than it was with Lenin. Because there's this, just to give you, can I just add, because you know, in the 1980s when Solidarnosc came onto the scene in Poland, because they were a radical sort of trade union movement, and he once said that Lenin would have loved Solidarnosc, and I say, no, I don't think so, because Solidarnosc was a radical trade union movement that didn't have a political party. It wasn't attached to any political party, whereas Lenin would not have liked something like that going along.
No. Right. And Rosa Luxemburg might have, because she thought that the task for the vanguard, revolutionary vanguard, was not to, from a centralized place of authority, direct activity, but to basically lend support, material support and intellectual support to the activities that the proletariat themselves will be led to through their struggle against capital, and it was based on something like an immiseration thesis, that because of the tendency for crisis and over and under consumption, to put it in Rosa Luxemburg's terms, there would be moments of real radical revolutionary struggle between that, the life and death struggle between the working class and the capitalist class around wages and hours worked and, you know, safety conditions, all sorts of things would drive the working class into a revolutionary conflict. I can see why, if you believed that, something like the Great Depression would be deflationary, you know, when you make you question your core values, because it seems like there really were forces at work that drove the proletariat into conflict with the capitalist class, but they also drove the proletariat of different nations into identification with the bourgeois, you know, classes or the capitalist classes of their nations, and set them at war with each other at the same time. And that's how the crisis was expressed, and then it was how it was resolved. It was as an international conflict between bourgeois nations rather than as a class conflict. So I worry that we are going to look at something, you know, a repeat of that today, but I can't see the future. But I guess I want to bring up CLR James to you. I mean, the reason this conversation is going on is because I wonder if there's an understanding of Lenin that I need to grasp that would avoid what looks like the failure of the Soviet Union and the failure of too centralized and vanguardist an approach, and overcome the problems that maybe the people who side with Rosa Luxemburg end up with, which is that, you know, you don't beat the bourgeois class that way. You don't actually win the minds of the working class that way. And that, you know, they go into conflict with each other rather than uniting together in a class struggle.
You know, Victor Serge once sort of wrote on the problem of Stalinism that its germs come from Leninism. And that is a very sort of problem that we are going to have to grapple with, is that the Russian Revolution failed, and that it was, in a sense, always going to fail. It was always going to, it was a tragedy, and it was always going to be a tragedy, partially because of where it took place and the time period it took place in, obviously going through a civil war and, you know, foreign intervention and then the revolution then degenerated into Stalinism, which is, you know, one of the most horrific things ever seen. And I think on this point, I actually agree with Zizek that this 20th century way of doing things kind of has to die before we can move forward. You know, I'm not trying to quite dodge your question, but I think for me, I can only look at this from the way of critique. I can't really give you a solution quite to that question.
How are you feeling about what's going on in the world right now and the protests that are springing up around the murder of George Floyd and I think also around a lot of other things, like the unemployment rate globally in the United States is behind this as well. But what are you feeling looking at the massive protests that are going on or that have gone on?
I think it's clear that George Floyd's murder was a spark. It certainly ignited, you know, the biggest an uprising, you know. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. A series of uprisings that haven't been seen across the United States since the 1960s, because previously when you had similar actions in Ferguson or in 2014 or in Cincinnati in 2001 or in Baltimore in 2015 after Freddie Gray, it was just contained within those cities. But with George Floyd, it's across the whole nation. And obviously, I think it shows that, one, that that this issue of police brutality, especially against Black people, that there is, you know, this is the straw that's broken the camel's back. I think there is something that feels a little bit different this time than you did than with previous cases, and because of the fact that it's taking place within the pandemic, and people have been in lockdown for 3 months. There's an economic crisis with the what people call the violence we've seen. I think that's a big explanation for it.
Someone asked a question that I was planning on asking you never got to, which is your thoughts on CLR James' theory of state capitalism and how it differs from other theories of state capitalism. Do you think that his turn towards the Black Vanguard thesis was connected to his understanding of the Soviet Union as a state capitalist formation?
Well, with the James and his relationship to state capitalism and Black worker, yeah, because his view on the sort of organic vitality of Black proletariat is obviously linked with his rejection of the Soviet Union, because he found that, you know, that sort of ultra authoritarianism was connected with, you know, the sordid nature of the Vanguard Party.
You know, my understanding of the state capitalist theory that CLR James and Ryan Doyskaya put together is the Forrest Johnson tendency, or the Johnson-Forrest tendency. It's just that it came down to the fact that commodity production continued to dominate the Soviet Union, and that because even though there was centralized authority, and even though everything was directed through the state, and the state owned the modes of production, and the state was supposed to represent the working class, despite that, the primary definition, the way to understand capitalism, is not based on property relationships alone, but also on the aim of production. So if the aim of production is to create commodities for exchange, and the exchange of those commodities based on the labor time that they embody, roughly, then that's capitalism. And that without the dictatorship of the proletariat and the transformation of the mode of production, you weren't going to even get to socialism, let alone communism, although that distinction is questionable one anyhow. But I think that would be their theory. I don't know the other one. The other one is some trot theory. Yeah,
Tony Cliff.
Tony Cliff's theory, and I don't know it.
Yeah, neither. I'm not.
Do you know it?
No, I'm not that familiar with it. Otherwise, I'll embarrass myself.
I've been told about it.
Yeah. Sort of descriptions of the Soviet Union, like some orthodox Trotskyists would call it the degenerated worker state. Like, because they'll say it has some redeemable features, but the Stalinist nature of it sort of degenerates it, because it's progressive because of its industrialized Russia and so on and so forth.
The thing that I want to point out is about the Soviet Union is that we can't – I think it's important, if we're going to be revolutionaries, not to completely reject what was the most successful thing about the Russian Revolution, which was that it was the expression of a working class will that brought the Bolsheviks into power ultimately, and that it really was an attempt towards a socialist revolution, probably the only successful attempt. So
I think you could say from 1917 till 1922, that was when the Bolshevik Revolution was at its peak and pomp. And that was, you know, it was obviously afterwards, that's when the certain events, you know, brought Stalin into power. And also another progressive aspect of the Russian Revolution that later on bore fruit was the eventual disintegration of the European empires, because it helped ignite sort of anti-colonial sentiments around the world.
Look, I enjoyed the conversation. I want to keep you around after the live stream ends, because I want to basically, I'll say it on the live stream, I'd love it if you could write a book for Zero sometime, just because I'm enjoying reading your work and talking to you both, so we should talk about that. But for now, I'll run the out clip, and but stick around.